Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A likely fracture between the House and the Senate is emerging over the matter of forcing more public school construction money to go to charter schools.
Because it's difficult and challenging for districts to come up with the money to be able to fund those major expenditures. Building a new school today is not cheap.
Also tonight, supporters of LGBT non-discrimination legislation say this year they got close, but their effort will have to wait for next session.
This was realistic. If we moved this out of this committee, there was a realistic chance of seeing this on one of the floors for sure.
We'll also delve into gambling, state worker retirement plans, and movie making, among other things. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's Ash Wednesday and the official midpoint of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House has moved forward with a proposal to reduce the cost of school construction and steer more dollars to charter schools. Lynn Hatter reports over the objection of school superintendents, the House Appropriations Committee approved the bill, but it could face challenges in the state Senate.
House Bill 879 outlines how the state awards building funds to small rural districts, but it also includes language that would punish districts that go over state spending caps. Amendments by Miami Republican Representative Eric Frezen require districts that raise building funds locally to share that money with charter schools, something some lawmakers have tried to get through the legislature for years. Frezen says there's no conspiracy.
This is not Representative Frezen against superintendents who are trying to do something to disparage school systems. This is just an exercise by this committee to recognize that in a time where there's no appetite in either chamber to go from the 1.5 mils back to 2, let's take a holistic look at how that 1.5 is being spent.
Mills are the additional taxes districts can levy to support maintenance and construction. But superintendents view the bill with suspicion. They've been adamantly opposed to the idea of sharing locally generated dollars with charters. Frezen says he's just trying to put an end to the back and forth and set out a system for divvying up funds everyone can follow.
The concept in this PCS is to depoliticize that conversation, not make it a session-by-session thing of which leader or which appropriations chair or which Senate president or speaker is more pro-charter school, more conventional, but just recognize that facilities are facilities, and the best way to depoliticize something is to put blinders on it, create a formula that's going to be able to be sustainable, and let the formula work.
Frezen and the Superintendents Association have engaged in a war of words over a report that Frezen says shows districts have spent $1 billion more than state spending caps allow on building and maintenance over the past decade. Superintendents say that report does not paint an accurate picture of how those decisions are made. But Frezen says the report was generated off information provided by the districts. Escambia County Superintendent Malcolm Thomas says schools cannot afford to lose a portion of their building funds. And he says for his district, the expenses are due to the age of the buildings. He says the average age of schools in his district is more than 45 years.
We built a new school this year, and the main building of that school was over 100 years old. Because it's difficult and challenging for districts to come up with the money to be able to fund those major expenditures. Building a new school today is not cheap.
Thomas says the current system, which sets spending caps based on a per-student allocation, does not reflect what it actually costs to build a facility. And he says the state should consider using square footage as a better measure. Democratic Minority Leader Mark Pafford believes the bill will make it harder for districts to fund schools.
Perhaps we can tap the brakes on this if we're going to look at changing these type of issues and either look at next year or just stopping it now so we can actually get greater input before it hits the floor.
The bill would require state economists to review the caps. The House Appropriations Committee approved the bill on a largely party-line vote, with Democratic Representative Daryl Roussan of St. Petersburg joining Republicans in support. But the superintendents may have better luck in the Florida Senate. Republican Senator Ana Terry Flores has a similar measure, but it's strictly limited to how building funds for small rural districts are allocated. Flores's bill does not include the charter school language. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The third time was not the charm Tuesday evening for advocates of a lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights measure. Nick Evans reports senators remain deadlocked, effectively precluding any chance of passage this session.
Senator Ring, I listened to your comments you just made, and some of you may or may not know this, but the next committee stop would have been Senator Ring's committee. And he agreed to take this up, this very bill up, next week.
Did you hear that?
He wanted this
that shift in Wellington Democratic Senator Joseph Abruzzo's phrasing? The next committee stop would have been Senator Ring's. That's the moment it became clear this year's LGBT civil rights measure was finally dead.
You know, where we are right now, we are still deadlocked. It is 5-5. I have not gotten commitments from any member on this committee that they will move off the current position. So we are currently deadlocked. I don't believe that this is the right thing to do, but I believe we need to move it forward. But you either have the votes or you do not have the votes. And I stand in front of you, and I appreciate Senator Simmons' motion, but we do not have the votes at the present time, unless somebody speaks up. But we're deadlocked.
Technically, the Florida Competitive Workforce Act—that's what the sponsors are calling it—is just postponed. But for all intents and purposes, the measure's done. It has a short path in the House, but speaking after the fact, Abruzzo explained it's unlikely to get a hearing.
I was of this firm belief that if we moved ours, they were going to start moving theirs. They wanted to see progress from the Senate. They only
progressed. Even though it's been around for 10 years, it's come up in this committee within really the last 2 weeks.
This is Patrick Slevin with Florida Businesses for a Competitive Workforce, a business organization lobbying in favor of the bill.
To be fair to our Republican senators, they really haven't had a chance to get a full understanding of the Competitive Workforce Act in its entirety. And so we understand when there's some narrow perspectives that we need as a coalition to help educate.
And the Senate Judiciary Committee this year has been fascinating. Three times Republican Committee Chair Miguel Diaz de la Portilla has brought up the LGBT anti-discrimination bill. He's also stonewalled two controversial gun measures and two immigration-related bills. He and Altamonte Springs Republican David Simmons joined the panel's Democrats in supporting the non-discrimination measure after an amendment penned by Simmons gained approval. But despite efforts among supporters in the legislature and out to pitch the bill along economic development lines, the debate and the five remaining Republican votes got bogged down in arguments over a different aspect of the bill.
You know, what I heard yesterday from the committee is a lot of common ground. A lot of common ground on housing, on employment. And what it seemed like it came down to is a few minor issues on public accommodations. Issues
that's Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto. And he's referring to an argument that came up last year. What happens with transgender men and women when it comes to bathrooms? But LGBT advocacy group Equality Florida calls that a red herring, claiming panel members turned down an amendment carving out restrooms and locker rooms. And supporters say this bill's failure could have far-reaching effects. For instance, the governor's office is lobbying for $250 million to attract new businesses.
Curiously enough, I sat on a governor's committee in 2014 focused on one of his pillars for economic growth, which was the tech industry.
This is tech data executive John Tonneson. His business is one of the state's largest public corporations, and he believes this episode undermines the state's economic development efforts.
This bill, or the absence and the kind of testimony and discussion we see here, I think absolutely works against the state's brand as being a progressive, leading-edge state, and that in an industry like tech will be an inhibitor and a limiter.
For the time being, supporters plan to regroup. Abruzzo says it'll be the first bill he files for the coming session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
still to come on Capitol Report. A major gaming bill has passed its first committee in the House.
Basically, what this bill does in about 100 pages is it decouples greyhounds, decouples harness racing, decouples quarter horses.
As some state lawmakers look towards state worker pension reform, that issue is drawing the ire of others.
We should make sure that they don't have to go to sleep at night worrying about their pension because we're putting them in a position where they might be having to roll the dice.
And some state lawmakers are sick of seeing movies supposedly showing Florida scenes that were actually shot out of state.
And again, it's the number one determining factor of where a high-impact production will go. So we are missing out on these opportunities daily.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
A proposed gaming agreement between Florida and the Seminole Indian tribe is moving forward, but Regan McCarthy reports legislative leaders don't expect discussions surrounding the bill to end soon.
Members of the House Regulatory Affairs Committee passed a measure Tuesday to ratify the $3 billion gambling agreement negotiated by the tribe and governor's office.
It is a product of countless conversations, a seemingly endless back and forth of negotiations, and a mountain of reading which has all but consumed the lives of those involved in the negotiations.
That's Committee Chair Jose Felix Diaz. He was involved in the compact negotiations and is charged with ushering the committee's gaming bills through the process. Lawmakers tied the compact ratification bill to another bill that deals with gaming outside the tribe's activities.
Basically, what this bill does in about 100 pages is it decouples greyhounds, decouples harness racing, decouples quarter horses, decouples Calder. It creates a purse pool for Tampa Bay.
The measure also bars officials from issuing new permits and requires them to void any dormant permits. It approves new locations for slot machines and caps the number that are allowed and requires those who continue greyhound racing to report injuries. But it's that first idea, decoupling horse racing, that has members of the horse industry concerned. Decoupling means paramutual facilities would be able to continue offering certain types of card games without being required to hold a certain number of races. Gordon Reese represents the Florida Thoroughbred Breeders. He says the change could hurt his industry.
My concern at this point is how do we get to the point where the gaming industry is more important than a $1 billion agricultural-based thoroughbred industry statewide, which employs 12,000 people with an annual payroll of over $400 million. How can we pass a bill where the fiscal impact has not been determined, where you do not know what the impact will be financially on your constituents?
But Monticello Republican Representative Halsey Bashir says it might be time for the horse industry to make changes.
You know, in terms of your business, and that's what it is, you need to continue to look for ways to change your business, need to look for ways to change your customer, because that's what happened is you have lost your customer here in this business. And as sad as it is, and it kills the industry, it kills your industry, which overall does hurt ag and hurts the state of Florida. Unfortunately, your customer has left you so.
The legislation also paves the way for slot machines at some paramutuals, but not others. Lawmakers questioned how officials made that decision, and Diaz says that decision generally reflects efforts to protect tribe exclusivity.
The Seminole tribe has varying levels of discomfort with where their exclusivity is encroached upon, and Lee County specifically is a point of higher heartburn than other places because it is so close to the Immokalee land.
But Diaz has said he's willing to pursue the possibility of adding more paramutuals to the list that could offer slots under the compact, including Gretna, where voters have already approved the move through a referendum and lawyers are fighting for a permit in court. Meanwhile, the House committee also approved a measure that would require any future gaming changes to get approval from voters. And Winter Haven Republican Representative John Wood proposed an amendment to require a similar vote before passing the compact this time. And while the move failed, that's something Miami Beach Democratic Representative David Richardson says he wonders about, too.
Going forward, if it would require a referendum, why would we not put the issue of this these issues before the people now? So I'm just trying to understand why we trust ourselves to make good decisions, but we're not going to trust future legislators.
But Diaz says a referendum on the current compact wouldn't be possible without changing timelines and getting approval again from both the governor and the tribe. Though Diaz told reporters after the meeting, the measure requiring voter approval for future changes will likely be an important part of pushing the compact through the legislature this time. A Senate committee was also expected to vote on gaming measures Tuesday, but after lawmakers proposed significant changes, the committee chair decided to postpone the vote. Diaz says he wouldn't be surprised if discussions on the bills continue up to the very end of the legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A renewed effort in the House to make changes to Florida's retirement system is getting some mixed reviews among public employee unions. We get that report from Sasha Cordner.
Pension reform has always been a top priority for House Speaker Steve Crisafulli. But as in years past, an attempt to overhaul the state retirement system failed last session, in part because it didn't have the votes needed to pass in the Senate. But this year, Crisafulli says he's not giving up.
For us, it's about finding where we can work with the Senate to find a common ground.
Past pension reform proposals have included eliminating the traditional pension plan, a popular retirement option known as a defined benefit plan. Another idea also made the other retirement option the default for new hires. It's known as the 401k style investment plan or the defined contribution plan. That's included in a similar proposal spearheaded by North Fort Myers Republican Representative Matt Caldwell as chair of the House State Affairs Committee, who's leading Crisafulli's charge on pension reform. This year's proposal also allows those who have left state employment to be able to renew their membership into the investment plan if they reemployed with the state. That's currently not the case for either of the retirement options. Caldwell says a proposal also creates new survivor benefits for members of the investment plan who are killed in the line of duty. Today, that's only offered in the pension plan.
This is the most significant change, I think, in the bill. Everyone who is in the investment plan would receive the same death benefit as you receive if you were in the pension plan.
I think the survivor benefit is long overdue. It breaks my heart. I actually know of a few folks that this is going to be a direct benefit to, and to be in opposition to the overall package is difficult for our organization.
That's Matt Puckett with the Florida Police Benevolent Association, who says while he likes most of the bill, switching the default from the pension plan to the investment plan is a major concern. James Tolley, representing the Florida Professional Firefighters, had similar issues.
Someone that defaults into the investment plan that needs to make a change, this default is going to hurt a lot more.
Rich Templin with AFL-CIO also had issues with that particular provision, calling the pension plan the more secure and superior option. Plus, he says it will also cost the state more money, according to a study commissioned by lawmakers last year.
The cost to the state will increase by making this default change.
Gail Marie Perry, representing Communication Workers of America, says she's had a negative experience with the investment plan.
That's what they say the stock market does. It helps you get it back. You lose, you win. But then in 2007, I lost 40% of my pension again.
But Miami Republican Representative Michael Beleka had a different one.
My father was a teacher under an investment plan, far outstrip over time any of the benefits in a defined benefit.
But Daytona Beach Democratic Representative Dwayne Taylor disagrees.
I liken this to the jelly donut. It looks really good. It looks scrumptious and you put that poison pill on the inside of that. And it looks like it's something that you can eat and it's not going to do any harm to you, but it does.
And he says he intends to work with Caldwell moving forward to fix the default provision. Still, the bill passed the House State Affairs Committee 10-8 with some Republicans joining Democrats in opposition. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Some Florida lawmakers want to change the way homeowners manage insurance claims, and Ashley Tressel has that story.
Many homeowners use assignment of benefits after an emergency to hand insurance payment directly to contractors. But former insurance consumer advocate Steve Burgess says assignments can lead to higher premiums.
What we're seeing from the data is that it's something that adds costs, and in some circumstances a lot of costs to the product. And what we want to do is make sure that consumers aren't paying for unnecessary costs embedded within the insurance product.
Critics say the practice opens the door to fraudulent claims from contractors who ask insurance companies to pay more than necessary to complete a job. This causes insurers to raise premiums. The Consumer Federation of the Southeast wants to prevent this from happening. Executive Director Jennifer West says homeowners can be taken advantage of if they don't understand what they're signing.
We're very happy to see some safeguards in place so that the fraud that seems to be on the rise will be prohibited from happening and the consumers will be protected.
Republican Senator Dorothy Huckel from Port Orange is sponsoring a bill that would make the process clear to homeowners. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ashley Tressel.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. A packed agenda looms before lawmakers tomorrow as we hear from Ronald J. Eben.
Thursday is Apprenticeship Day at the state capitol. It all begins at 7:30, hands-on demonstrations of the apprenticeship training with equipment and machinery used in various trades. The House goes into session starting at 9 o'clock. The Senate is scheduled to hold the floor session at 1 p.m. The Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Subcommittee meets at 10 o'clock Thursday morning. Among the bills on the agenda are measures that deal with compensation to victims, the wrongfully accused, human trafficking, and suspended driver's licenses. Also scheduled to meet are the Senate Education Appropriations Subcommittee at 10 a.m., the Senate General Government Appropriations Subcommittee also at 10, and the Senate Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee also at 10 a.m. And those are some of the legislative agenda highlights for Thursday, February 11th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, lights, camera, money. State lawmakers want to put Florida back on the silver screen by rebooting the state's film incentives program. Kate Payne reports lawmakers are tired of watching films about Florida that were actually shot in other states.
Coming soon to a theater near you is Ben Affleck's newest project, Live by Night. Set in Prohibition-era Ybor City, the film features South Florida's vibrant history of rum running and organized crime. But the film wasn't shot in Ybor City. In fact, it wasn't shot in Florida at all. With the state's film incentives drying up, it was cheaper for Affleck's production to build their own Ybor City in Brunswick, Georgia, less than 300 miles away. Roberto Torres owns a cafe in Ybor City, and he says this was a missed opportunity for his business.
This is like thinking like a comet, right, that comes every 1,000 years. This was one of it. The other thing is that the comet comes back. This one is not going to come back. Yeah.
Senator Nancy Dietert of Venice is tired of seeing films about Florida slip away to states with better incentives. In 2010, the Florida legislature put forward some $260 million of incentives. The money was supposed to last 6 years, but ran out halfway through. Now Dietert is going back to the drawing board.
Georgia is beating the pants off of us. They've got the Ybor City story, which they should have never gotten. They got the Highwaymen, which is a Florida story. But their poison pill in their process is that they have no cap on their incentives. So that's not a sustainable program long run. Short run, they can beat us, but in the long run, they cannot.
But Florida isn't the only state vying for Hollywood's affection. Georgia, Alabama, Texas, and North Carolina all offer incentives to lure productions away from New York and Los Angeles. Dale Gordon represents Film Tampa Bay, and she says incentives play a huge role, and Florida isn't keeping up.
Just yesterday, I spoke with CBS, and they have a television pilot that's based on two four-star generals in Tampa, Florida, at our military base, and they are going to most likely do it in L.A. or Louisiana. And again, it's the number one determining factor of where a high-impact production will go. So we are missing out on these opportunities daily.
Despite the strong competition in Atlanta and New Orleans, Senator Dietert wants to get Florida's film industry back on track. Dietert says her plan will correct for past mistakes and sustain the program long term.
We're going to have an empowered film commissioner that can field projects and say, this is a good one, this is not a good one. What killed our process here was first come, first serve. You're not getting the best project, you're getting the first one through the door.
Incentives are great, industry insiders say, but they're not everything. Florida boasts two of the top film schools in the nation, the College of Motion Picture Arts at Florida State and Ringling's College of Art and Design. Yet every year, qualified, talented film school grads flee to the Hollywood Hills. Senator Jeremy Ring supports Dietert's plan, but he says policy should encourage a creative workforce, not just cut taxes.
But I truly believe that when we do these economic development packages, we need to be thinking a whole new paradigm in a way. You know, we need to be thinking more about an innovation economy.
Dietert has attached her proposal to the Senate Economic Development Bill. With the support of influential Senator Jack Latvala of Clearwater, Dietert may see her plan through. The bill will get its second hearing Thursday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Ashley Tressel and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.